I need to say to each welcome visitor in this house that we are nearing the end of a series of sermons about the life of Christ, and that I have chosen this Sunday to talk about what is called His Transfiguration, an event which is celebrated in art and mentioned once in a while from pulpits, but which is not often made the topic of an entire sermon, as I plan to do this morning. The story is a very strange one. I would like to show you how each gospel writer added his own touches to it, and why there are good reasons to believe it may have ended up in a very different form from what it was in the beginning. If you heard Ray Kochner read the scripture a few minutes ago, you know that the story goes something like this. Jesus takes three close friends up on a mountain to pray. At some time during this mini retreat, he is transfigured. That is, his appearance is changed, and his garments, the story says, become blindingly white. Moses and Elijah, a pair who have been dead for centuries, show up, according to the story, and have a talk with Jesus as if this were the most natural thing in the world. And the Apostle Peter suddenly announces that maybe it would be a great idea if he put up three tents, one for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Jesus. It's such an odd proposal that Mark tries to explain it by saying that Peter was scared out of his wits and simply did not know what else to say. In any event, he gets no response. It's as if no one hears him. But a cloud suddenly closes in around the little group on the hilltop, and the story says the voice of God rumbles out of the cloud, ignoring Moses and Elijah, but identifying Jesus as the chosen one to whom everybody should now listen. Then Moses and Elijah vanish as abruptly as they came, and Jesus and his three friends are alone again with no cloud, no voice, no apparitions from the past, no shining face or glowing garments. What are we supposed to do with this story? We live in the 20th century, an age of science. We plot courses for satellites to the far edges of the solar system and beyond. How is this story supposed to speak to us in 1990? Christian people around the world take one or the other of two basic approaches to this story. If they have been trained to read every word of the Bible literally, then they simply say that however odd the story may seem, however far removed from the kind of world they live in, it had to have taken place exactly as the words suggest at first glance. That is, an actual, external happening, which if you had been there with a camcorder, you could have caught on film, the colors, the moving shapes, the sounds of human voices, the sound of God's voice. But there are many other Christians who understand this story to be written in a kind of code language, operating on poetic and symbolic levels, and not intended, even by the first people who told it, to be interpreted as a literal historical event in every detail. Since that happens to be my own view of the story, I'd like to make that interpretation as plausible as I can, and then, as always, leave it to you as to how you wish to read the story. I will be trying to compress what it should take 2 or 3 hours to do into about 20 minutes. So if you will pretend that this is an explanation you've been waiting to hear for half a lifetime, we'll start like this. One thing a serious Bible student discovers is that Christian scripture was very consciously shaped in ways that would make it echo the themes and the stories of the Jewish religion out of which Christianity was born. Deliberate shaping. That is why, to quote the Cambridge History of the Bible, I wanted somebody to be in this position besides just myself, the gospel tradition, I'm quoting, took the form we know. Now, forgive me for rephrasing that line, but it's vital to the point I will try to make. What it says is that the gospel traditions have come down to us in their present form, not because every detail is literally true, but because the writers felt compelled to make the life of Jesus echo the great lives and themes of Jewish scripture. There's a special name for that, typology, which you can promptly forget. It can be shown how this works for weeks at a time in a classroom, and I have done it, but we have time only for a quick glimpse of how the practice may have been at work in our story of the Transfiguration. When Jesus went up on the mountain, he took 3 friends, Peter, James, and John. But why not just the 2 brothers? Why not take Andrew and make it 4? Is it simply an accident that the story says he took 3? Or is this an intentional shaping of the story to make it echo the journey of Moses up to Mount Sinai when he took 3 of his closest friends, Nadab, Aaron, and Abihu? Every preacher candidate in seminary learns that Christians liked to think of Jesus in the early days when the scripture was being written as the second Moses. Hunting parallels between the 2 of them, even when they had to stretch them quite a bit. Matthew collects, for example, the scattered discourses of Jesus, and then turns them into a single great Sermon on the Mount. Luke talks about some of the very same ideas. But for Luke, it's a sermon in the valley, on the plain. Why is it a Sermon on the Mount for Matthew? Well, it's because Moses, and Matthew really likes to work at these parallels, Moses had gotten the old law on a mountain. Jesus should deliver the new message from God on a mountain also. Is it only a coincidence or more than that? When Jesus and his friends are up on the top, two other personalities show up, Moses and Elijah. Why these two? Why not Abraham, the great patriarch? Or Noah, saved from the fabulous flood? Or Adam, first child of God in the legends of Genesis? No good reason, I think, except this one. In Jewish tradition, two men were associated with a high mountain. Moses, who went up among the clouds, heard the voice of God, and received the law. And Elijah, greatest of the prophets, who also went up on that same mountain and heard the voice of God. These two men stood for the two great pillars of the Jewish religion, the law and the prophets. By having them show up, the story is given a special theological depth. No Jew could miss the point that is being made when both of them show up in honor of Jesus and hear God say pointedly, "This is my chosen. Listen to him." In other words, the code language is saying that Jesus is superior to both of them. This is Christian scripture, remember. The Jewish law, the honored prophets, are now yielding their places in history to Christ. If you're still listening, the parallels begin to mount up. The cloud that comes over, reminiscent of that cloud out of which God spoke to Moses. The face of Jesus shining, just as the face of Moses did on Mount Sinai, so that, according to Exodus 34, the skin of his face sent out rays. Now, when you also find out that in those days a white garment symbolized one who belongs to the heavenly world, then the poetry of this whole transfiguration story begins to seem, to me at least, too beautifully contrived to belong to the world of prosaic and often shapeless history. What we have, many believe, is a parable story built up carefully around some kernel of historic fact in such a way as to deliver an important message to the early church. That it may not have happened literally in the form given to it by the Gospels, is suggested by some other puzzles which are hard to solve if the present story is actual history. For example, how do we make sense of the behavior of the Apostle Peter a short time later when he was such a total coward and denied with an oath that he so much as knew Jesus? All because he thought that was the only way to save his life. Does it really seem logical to you that Peter could have acted this way if he had actually been on that mountain? Put yourself in his place. You need to do this always if you're serious about trying to understand the Bible. You see divine power blaze out of Jesus in a miracle, his face glowing like the sun, his robe supernaturally bright, God himself, speaking out of a cloud, two men long dead showing up for a conversation. Could you have forgotten something like that? If you had literally witnessed such power, heard the actual voice of God, would you tremble before the power of mortal men? Doesn't it make more sense to read the Transfiguration story as an event of symbolic truth, while the denial of Peter in the courtyard is an event of literal truth? Here is another puzzling problem. Although we are told in all three versions of this story that Jesus said unequivocally on the mountain that he would rise from the dead, we learn to our great surprise that when women came from the empty tomb to say that Jesus was risen, it all seemed like an idle story to the disciples. And I'm quoting, they did not believe it. How is that possible? If the Transfiguration story is to be read literally, then three of these men had already seen miracle upon top of miracle on that mountain. And then they had heard their supernaturally glorified master specifically speak of the resurrection. How could they be surprised a short time later to be told that he had risen? They act as if the Transfiguration event had never happened. Or at least they act as if it had not happened in the way it is told to us now. I'm tempted to say at this moment, friends, Wichitans, countrymen, lend me your ears for just a few more minutes of this very compressed argument. There is certainly good reason to think that whatever kernel of truth became the source of this story, it got changed along the way. Mark and Luke, for example, do not agree on what Peter called Jesus when he spoke to him. Matthew changes his account in order to make Peter look better than he does in Mark by changing the way he suggests building the tents. And Mark, probably the first to put this story in written form, does not mention the face of Jesus shining. It is not in Mark. But Matthew adds that detail to his account, saying that the Lord's face shone like the sun. Well, I think I know the reason. Matthew, as I have told you more than any other, liked to make the life of Jesus parallel the life of Moses. So he is constantly creating echoes where his source may not have any. The face of Moses shone like the rays of the sun, so the face of Jesus, the second Moses, must also shine like the rays of the sun. Matthew adds another thing to Mark's version. Matthew alone says that when the disciples hear the divine voice, they fall down on their faces. But Jesus comes to touch them and to say, stand up and don't be afraid. Why would Matthew add this when there's not a word about it in Mark, the gospel we know he is copying? Well, I think the answer is that Matthew wanted his readers to connect with another story in Jewish scripture where a heavenly voice speaks to a human being. The parallels between that story in Daniel and our story in Matthew 17 are remarkable. A shining face in each one, a divine voice, a falling on the ground, a being touched, an admonition to stand up and not be afraid, a lifting up of the eyes. I doubt that all these similarities are just an accident. Gospel writers did not merely record history, they shaped stories in order to nurture the faith of the early church. Now, you have a right to know how some Christians would reconstruct this story without some of the worshipful additions and the theological intensifying that took place as it passed from one person to another through the years. What many readers think may have been the small seed of literal event out of which this story sprouted and grew slowly into a creative lesson in code language for the church to hear and profit from. So, stripped down to a real moment in history, without the symbolism and the poetry, I think, something like this may have given birth to the story. Jesus, by this time in his brief ministry, is finding out how hard it is to make people see the light. How easy it is, in fact, to make them so angry at being disturbed that they begin to talk about killing him. Now, the problem is that he is positive he has a mission from God. How is that going to be accomplished if he dies within a few more weeks or months? What is God doing that he implants within one a sense of holy mission and yet allows deadly hatred to build within the opposition until it seems almost certain the mission will never be fulfilled? In what I would think to be an agony of doubt and bewilderment, Jesus decides to withdraw to the top of a mountain to pray about his problem. It may have taken hours, but somewhere in that turmoil, he found the answer. In a flash of high and terrible insight, he realizes that his death will be the means by which his hope and his ministry will be fulfilled. His execution will not be the end of everything, but the beginning. This loneliest of human beings, once so confident, but watching now the opposition build, has caught from his communion with God the answer. The cross will turn defeat into victory. And I, if I be lifted up, will draw all people unto me. I believe that in that incredible moment, when he turned back to his painfully dense disciples, his face was shining with the radiance of a great new certainty, and the change in his looks and manner quite literally amazed his friends. as they thought about it, in the many years after he was gone, tried to make sense of it, put it in the code language of their Jewish background, the story expanded to become what we have heard this morning, overlaid with symbols so that all their readers would understand it. If we, in our own way, can get beneath the symbolism and find the face of an anguished human being and see it transfigured before our very eyes as he wins a victory over death, then the life of Jesus becomes as real and poignant as I think it has to be for most of us in this room. It also helps to remember that such a transfiguration can happen to us. I have seen it happen. In fact, beautifully, to all kinds of people. Conservative Christians, liberal Christians, Christians who don't even know what those two adjectives mean. And when I have seen it, seen the lives change and the faces become radiant from an inner peace and certainty, then I know how I can believe in the permanent reality which in the code language of another time this story still expresses. If you were to read it this afternoon, perhaps some of you would find it full of sense and beauty in ways you had not seen before. That would make my struggle worthwhile.